Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Hello, welcome. How are you doing today? So good to have you back. I had a fantastic weekend with my family, and Friday Night Magic was quite the experience last Friday. I did not do well at all. Trying a new deck in Standard, I'm going for black-white control, and it was rough. It was rough, I'll tell you that right now. So, yeah, I'm going to stick with it because we have a new set coming out in just a couple weeks. I cannot wait. Oh my gosh, if you are not plugged in to all the cool spoilers that are coming out for Eldritch Moon, please tune in. Like, there's so much cool stuff going on. You can always join our Facebook group. We have a thread there that we post about all the new spoilers and what we think. I mean, we have merge cards. I mean, come on. Like, how cool is that? Two cards that turn into one. It's amazing. So there's just a lot of cool stuff going on. Eldritch Moon comes out in a couple weeks, so I'm going to stick with black-white control until the new cards come out, and then we'll see what happens after that. I do want to say, if you are new to the show, welcome. A special welcome to you. MTG Pro Tutor has been growing so much lately that I'm sure that there are new listeners, and I want to say thanks for tuning in, welcome, and let you know kind of what you're getting into. Twice a week, we're going to sit down with the members of the Magic community. They are usually pro players, people who make top 8 of a Grand Prix, people who make top 16 of a Pro Tour, but sometimes they are community notables, such as other podcasters or presidents of Magic-related companies, or personalities that you just might recognize from being involved with Magic on the internet. We'll bring them in, we talk about Magic, we get their origin stories, specifically what we can learn from their highs, from their lows, and then any tips or tricks that they might be using that we haven't thought about yet. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, thank you. Because of you, we're here. It wouldn't be a show without you listening. So thank you for tuning in each and every week. It's a blast bringing these interviews to you, and I look forward to it each and every week. Speaking of what's going on in the Magic world, last weekend we had two Grand Prix. They were both Standard, one in Taipei and one in Pittsburgh. And holy smokes. Before we dive into the decks, real quick, in Taipei, Li Shitian took down third, and he's actually a past guest of the show, episode 38. If you want to go hear him, check it out. And GP Pittsburgh, there was Pascal Maynard, who got second place, and he is episode 109. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, wait a minute, the episode I'm listening to right now is episode 108, you're absolutely right. Pascal Maynard's episode comes out this Friday. Tune in to hear what he has to say, and just realize that when we give the introduction, it's one Grand Prix top 8 off, because we recorded before he went to the Grand Prix, and now that he's gone there, he has one more under his belt. So congratulations to him, that's so awesome. Now I want to dive in briefly to the decks. I took a quick look and I realized that 9 out of 16 decks, so look at the top 8 of both events, 9 out of the 16 decks were Bant Humans. 4 in Pittsburgh, 5 in Taipei. 5 out of the top 16 decks were Green-White Tokens. And then you had 1 Red-Green Ramp and 1 Sultai Midrange. So holy cow, if you're playing Standard right now, you need to be able to beat Bant Humans and Green-White Tokens. Go look up those deck lists, see what they're playing, practice against them, you know people are going to be playing it. And if it's your thing, if you can't beat them, join them. Like, those obviously seem to be the two best decks, so have at it. Either paint a target on their backs and find out how to beat them, or just practice, 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 and come out on top. Now, like I said, we do have new cards coming in about 3 weeks, so keep in mind that these decks will shift as new technology is released. That's really it. I can't wait to dive in with our guest today. If you remember the last episode, we talked to Max McVitie, and he talked about being part of Team Ann Arbor and how their team captain, Andrew Ellenbogen, took care of things like reservations and keeping the team together. Well, that's who we have today. We're diving in with the captain of Team Ann Arbor, Andrew Ellenbogen. So without further ado, let's dive right into the interview. What's up, everybody? I am super pumped to have our guest with us today. Our guest is the captain of Team Ann Arbor. He has 2 Grand Prix top 8s, Minneapolis and Omaha. The latter was with his favorite deck in all of Magic, Red Green Tron. He also finished 13-2 at Grand Prix Boston 2015 and cashed several other GPs and Star City games with that same deck. Coming to us from Michigan, let's welcome Andrew Ellenbogen. Andrew, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. How about you, Sean?
Fantastic. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with our audience tips and tricks to take their game to the next level?
I am.
Sweet. Now, all you prodigies out there, if you want to connect with Andrew, the best place to do that is on Twitter. He's at AJE 8888. That's Alpha Juliet Echo and then 4 8s. So just hit him up over there. You can say hello, say thanks for coming on the show, ask him questions, and we're ready to dive into Andrew's story. So Andrew, tell us, what do you have going on out there in Michigan? Is magic all you do? Do you have a job? Are you in school? What do you have going on?
I graduated from college about a year ago. Since then, I got a job at a software engineer. I'm a software engineer, and I work for a company that writes software for the building industry. They're like recently post-startup, so like 30-ish people, not too big, but not tiny. And I spend most of my free time playing Magic, but that's what I do for a living.
So what kind of software do you do?
Okay, basically, we write software for the building industry. So like if you are a large construction company and you have this detailed model of your building electronically, you can upload it to our site and then run these really flexible rules on it to check it that like the doors are all the right size for their frames and that like there's a fire alarm in every room and that kind of thing.
Nice. Very cool. So before we dive into the magic, you said magic is what you do on most of your free time. Do you have any other, you know, hobbies that you like to do?
I play League of Legends poorly. I play a lot of board games and card games. I'm a big fan of Hanabi. I'm a big fan of Splendor. I've recently been into backgammon, weirdly enough.
Nice.
I used to play chess competitively, but I'm retired. A lot of gaming things.
I love it. Now, I know Splendor. I like that one a lot. What was the other one that you said?
Hanabi. Hanabi is a cooperative game where basically no one can see their own hands. You can only see other people's hands. And you're trying to, like, through play, induce everyone to play their cards in the right order. And you all win or lose as a group.
I like that. That's neat. I love co-op games. Pandemic being one of the first ones I ever played. And my wife and I, we love that one. And group games often get to a point where there's one or two people that, you know, solve the game and then basically tell everybody how to play from there on out. It happens with us, you know, every time we play Pandemic or Forbidden Island, Forbidden Desert, whatever. And so my brother and I, we're trying to come up with an idea of like a co-op game that doesn't have one person solving it for everybody else. Because then everyone else is just sitting there being like, okay, I'll just do what you tell me to do. So I love co-op games.
Yeah, Hanabi will totally fix that problem because no one can see their own hand. No one knows what the right play is for anyone else. It depends on the hand they can't see. So everyone has to play well. When you win, it feels amazing because you know that every single player played to their fullest.
Man, that's great. I love that. It's so fun to hear some of the other things we have going on, some of the other games that we play and stuff like that. And that's a new one. I'll have to go look it up. So thanks for sharing. That is so cool. So diving in to the magic, let's just go to the beginning. Like, we love using stories and hearing, you know, how you started, bridging the gap between where you are and where we are. And so we want to hear, when was your first introduction to magic? What was that like?
Well, I started playing magic when I was like very, very young. I think my parents got me like a set of, like, I think I actually purchased a Molten Hydra in a store when I didn't even know how the game works. I thought the art looked cool. And then like, I think my parents got me that 7th edition starter set, the one that comes with the CD so you can battle the computer. And then I like played endless, endless games against the computer until I finally started like teaching everyone I know I play the game. This is like 4th, 5th grade. But I was really casual for a long time. And the reason I was casual is I would spend all my weekends at chess tournaments. Actually. And my chess team was pretty good in high school. We'd won 2 state championships. But what you have to remember is, like, I'm going to these chess tournaments, I'm, like, playing chess, and in between rounds, I'm playing magic with my chess team. Like, we all played both games. And then at some point, I started to realize that I was having way more fun playing magic than playing chess, and so I decided to go to my first Star City Games Open. And I actually, like, this was back in the days when they had draft opens. So, like, a draft open was, like, a 64-player event. You would, like, play a draft. Everyone who 3-0s makes top 8. And then you play a top 8 draft for, like, pretty big prizes. And I actually won this draft open, having, like, never played an event more competitive than FNM prior to this. And I was kind of hooked. And I don't know. I've been playing competitive Magic ever since.
That is way cool. So you won your first pretty much big event and got you hooked, just like you said. That's awesome. And you said you came in on 7th edition? That was the first set?
Yeah.
Now, have you been playing pretty solidly ever since then?
I mean, I have. Again, a lot of it was casual, but yes, I have.
So what's been your favorite set?
My favorite set? Well, when I think about sets, I really have trouble differentiating sets between limited formats. What makes a set good to me is mostly about limited. Some of it's about the flavor and some of it's about cool cards, but a lot of it is just like, how do I remember sweet draft decks I had and do I remember cool strategies I played in the limited format. And so I think my favorite is probably Innistrad. I know that's kind of a boring answer, it's what a lot of people say, but it's certainly true. I mean, I just played endless moto drafts of Innistrad, and I really enjoyed it.
Excellent. What was a sweet strategy that you did in Innistrad?
I definitely loved spider spawning, which I mean, a lot of people did. But what I would do my favorite deck I ever drafted before was I once drafted a spider spawning deck with two copies of Delver Secrets. So I was like Delver spawning, and it made my slots really tight because you need like 13 creatures to make spider spawning good and like 7 plus spells to make Delver good, but I managed to get it all in there. And see, at this time, I was like playing a lot of drafts in like Skype calls with all my friends. This was like how we would, I don't know, stay in touch and stay connected. And everyone in the call was like taunting me for this deck. They're like, what are you doing? You can't put these Delvers into spider spawning. Your deck's like 3 colors to support like the spider spawning flashback and the Delver cast. And you have some burial rites that you can flashback off Shimmering Grotto, so you actually have kind of a fourth color. Like, this deck can't possibly win a game. Like, who do you think you are? And I just, like, 3-0 the draft without losing a game.
Booyah!
So that was a great experience. I hooked a lot of Delvers naturally, and then my first dealt with them, my cast bonding was awesome.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. Along the same lines, do you have a favorite card?
Yes, I do. It's Karn Liberated.
Nice. Can you tell us what that is for those of us who don't know and why you like it?
Karn is a 7-mana Planeswalker. He +4s to exile a card from the opposing opponent's hand. So he goes with 4 loyalty. He starts 6 loyalty. He -3s loyalty to exile any permanent. And then he has -14. You restart the game with all permanents that are under Karn that have been exiled by him in play under your control.
Wow, that's crazy.
So, I mean, Karn's my favorite card because it's a card I've done a lot of sweet things with in my favorite deck. That's fun. But, yeah, I mean, like, I think my favorite is, like, I once won a game. So, okay, when you play Tron, the best hate card against you is a card called Sowing Salt. And, basically, the reason is that, like, Tron is trying to assemble these 3 specific lands. And if your opponent destroys one, you have enough ways to search for them that you usually be able to re-find it and like get Tron going again. But Sowing Salt exiles a Tron land and then lets you search the opponent's library for all copies of the same land and exile those too, and search their hand as well. So they end up with no copies of land in their deck and you can never reassemble Tron if your opponent Sowing Salt.
How much does that cost to cast?
2 red-red.
2 red-red. So how is that different than Crumple to Dust?
It just has the same exact text box as Crumble to Dust, but at the time of the story, Crumble to Dust had not been printed yet.
Yeah, Crumble to Dust is what, 3 red, I think?
Yeah.
Instead of 2 red-red?
They're very similar, it just doesn't have double red. Yeah. But basically, like, so my favorite thing I've done with Karn is, my opponent Sowing Salted my Urza's Towers, like, never reassembled them. Then, my opponent Sowing Salted my Urza's Mines, so I had very few lands left in my library. And my opponent had to exile all the copies of Wurmcoil Engine that I had. So, at that point, the only creature in my deck, the only way to kill my opponent, was Emrakul the Aeon's Horn, which cost 15 mana. And I didn't have 15 total lands left, because I had 8 of them exiled by these Sowing Salts. So, I had to figure out how to win. So what I did was, I played Karn, and I +4'd my opponent. He went down to no cards in hand. And then, the next, he like drew a card, didn't do very much on his turn, just like passed back. I untapped, and I +4'd Karn targeting myself, and I put Emrakul the Aeon's Horn under my Karn,
and then I
restart the game with my 15 mana Eldrazi in play.
Clever. That's awesome. Oh, man, you just blew my mind. Of course, I always thought Karn, you know, you target your opponent, but it says target player, so you can target yourself.
Yes.
Oh, man, smart. So you won, I'm assuming.
Yes. I did win the game. I started the game with Emrakul in play. It was pretty easy.
Oh my gosh. That's awesome. That's way cool. Thanks for sharing that. That is so neat. Taking a little different tack, do you know the story of Karn?
I could describe it vaguely. It's not an important part of why I like the card.
Okay. That's fine. We don't have to go in. I was just curious if you knew his lore or whatever, and we could dive into it a little bit, but no worries.
Yeah, I'm pretty mechanics-based, honestly. Like, I like that the cards have art so that I can identify them more easily, but it's not an important part of why I play the game. Who they are or what they represent. I'm mostly there to see cool mechanics in action.
Okay, excellent. So is that what makes Magic fun for you? Like, you like the mechanics, the interaction? Like, what has kept you around all these years? Like you mentioned, you started noticing, hey, I'm having more fun doing Magic instead of chess. Like, what was it that kind of hooked you and helped you click over?
Okay, yeah. So, well, part of it is, I mean, I can't get away from the fact that I'm unreasonably competitive. And, like, every aspect of my life, like, all the time, I'm super, I just need to win really badly. So it's certainly true that, like, I need a competitive outlet in some sense, and Magic certainly provides that. It definitely matters. But as to why I switched over, I basically switched over because chess, a lot of your games go the same way. Like, you memorize a long set of opening moves, and then you play this opening move you memorize every single game, and they're all kind of the same. Like, obviously, some interesting things can happen from there, but, like, your first four moves, you're just doing the same thing over and over again, round after round, turn after tournament, weekend after weekend. It gets really boring. Magic is never like that. Magic, like, there's all these different formats, all these different decks. You're doing something different every game of every match. You know, this game, you're really mana screwed. You can play one way. The next game, you got tons of mana, but you're really light on cards. You can play a totally different way. You know, every game is different. And I think that, combined with the competitive outlet thing, is really what's kept me around for many, many years.
Love it. The fluidity, just how no game is the same, like you said. And Magic is so good at that because, you know, we have limited. And so that's obviously cycling all the time. But then you have the constructed events, which also has a little bit of flux. And even though you might have the same archetypes matching up, like you said, sometimes you have this opener or that opener and you get mana flooded, mana screwed, and you have to figure out how do I win from here and do clever things like exile your own stuff. And I can totally see that. And I think that's one of the things that make Magic so great.
Yeah, agreed.
So as you came into Magic more heavily, when was there a period of time that you really feel that you leveled up, for example, that you started getting better? Because obviously you didn't start off, well, actually you kind of did start off like doing super good, you know, at big events, but you didn't start off by, you know, top 8 in Grand Prix and stuff like that. So what happened? Like, where was that period of time that really kind of helped you see the game differently?
So here's the deal. So I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's where I like grew up, and that's where I live now. But I went to college in Minnesota, and while I was in Minnesota, at some point, I'm playing a, like, random PTQ. I'm playing Tron, and at some point in the event, like, I'm X1 with, like, one round to go, so, like, I'm playing a win-it-in, and I play against Matthias Hunt. Now, I knew Matthias Hunt was, like, kind of a pro. So obviously I didn't really want to have that pairing. And in fact, he told me that he was actually already qualified for the Pro Tour, but like was basically blocking for people that he knew. And he beat me pretty soundly, but it was a very pleasant match. It was very nice to talk to him. And so after the match, I don't know, we just kind of go and sit down, you know, somewhere at the tournament and we get to talking. And I start to realize that, like, I don't know, I have a lot in common with this person. He also is an ex-chess player. And we kind of hit it off. We became good friends. And then, like, I don't know, a couple months after that, he invited me to this kind of elite test group he was running with the goal of trying to get on the PT. So, and at this test group, I got, like, a lot better very quickly. It's very likely that, like, for the first couple of sessions, I was one of the worst players in the entire room. Like, I was not as good as everyone else, and it was very clear. Like, I think I, like, 0-3 with my first draft deck I drafted up among these guys, and, like, it was tough. But I eventually got together, and I started, like, winning a lot more. I was suddenly, like, cashing like a ton of GPs that I was playing. I started queuing for PTs. I got my first Pro Tour qualification by going 13-2 in a Grand Prix, which was it's one of the few ways to qualify for a Pro Tour without winning airfare. But I paid for a plane ticket to Hawaii and I played that Pro Tour. And I don't know, basically once I started working with Matthias and I was testing with the test group, I just got a lot better victory.
That's awesome. And I love how you had that progression in your story. And I want to hone in on that when you got invited to this elite test group. First of all, how often were you guys meeting to play?
Once a week.
Now, you mentioned how the first couple times you recognized that you weren't the best one there. And I could just picture, for example, myself being in a situation like that. First of all, I'm going to be like, oh my gosh, they noticed me, you know, and I'm going to be so excited, stuff like that. And then I'm going to get there and I'm not going to be the best. And I understand that. But then I can just see myself kind of going, experiencing these feelings like, oh my gosh, like I suck. They're going to kick me out because I'm terrible. Did you like suffer from emotions like that as well? And if so, like, how did you move past it? Because, you know, there's a lot of people who might feel like that. Even if it's not with an elite group, they're just with their group of friends. They're like, oh my gosh, like, you know, I'm not as good as everybody else. And they just struggle with that self-doubt or whatever. Did you go through something like that or no?
Well, right. And the reason for this, right. Sorry. Yes. The reason for this is because although I was not like, I'd never been on the PT at that point. I never taught at a Grand Prix, but I had, or maybe I queued once, but it hadn't happened yet. Anyway, I was still one of the better players in the rooms when I was at like smaller events. And so I was used to kind of like assuming that my opinion was more likely to be right than people around me. I'm not saying that I wouldn't listen to them, just that like that I could talk about any issue, even if I wasn't that experienced on it. Because in most of the rooms I was in, I could. But in this room where I was one of the worst players, I really need to like shut up and listen. Like, you know, for example, like I should not, it was stuff like I could not offer my opinion on a card if I hadn't played with it, because like my base level opinion without having played with the card was worse than everyone else in the room. So unless I had some experience that they didn't, I just was not qualified to discuss it. And once I kind of realized that, and then people in the group talking about this, and they're like, you know, you gotta stop doing this. Like, you know, we like you, but like this is like you're not the best player here. And I calmed down and started listening, I got along way better with everyone in the group. And then I started winning a lot more. I mean, I started learning instead of being so focused on proving myself, basically.
I like that. And that's a really good insight, because yeah, I can see that unfolding, and I can see myself and others kind of feeling the same way. Like, hey, I have to prove myself, you know? And so I'm going to share my opinion so they know that, you know, I'm not a dummy or whatever. And in reality, you're like, look, like, it's cool. Like, you're here to learn. You don't have to pipe up about everything. So yeah, I can totally see that panning out, and I appreciate you, you know, sharing. So what was it that really clicked in that group? Because we all here play with people that are better than you, but what were you doing? Were you doing anything active, or was it just the fact that you were in this environment and you just kind of soaked it all up?
Well, part of it is about assembling the right group to start with. Now, in this case, I didn't do that. Matthias assembled the group. It was not me. But when you're assembling a test group, there's a lot of different factors to consider. You need a lot of different things in your test group. So for example, one thing is, like, I'm pretty talkative. You don't want everyone in your test group to be really talkative. You want some people who are more quiet. Another thing is, like, you want people with lots of different strengths and weaknesses so that every kind of base is kind of covered. So, for example, like, you want some players who are really good at building decks and can build original crazy ideas, like the brewers of your group. But you want some players who will just sit back and, like, evaluate ideas. Like, you show them a deck and they're like, this is not good. We should not do this. And then come another thing like this is our deck. And then you want some people who are very good players, some people who are better before the game starts with deck building portion. You want some people, just basically limited specialists and structured specialists. You just want a wide variety of players. And Matthias put together this group that had a lot of those qualities. Right, makes it quiet and loud. It had the people with a lot of different strengths and weaknesses. And like together, we were a lot stronger than individually.
What role did you fill?
Okay, so my biggest strength as a Magic player is that I have really good theory. So what theory means that, like, when you think about a game in really abstract terms, theory is your ability to, like, figure out how you're going to win, figure out what's important, without looking at any individual plays. And specifically, so when I was in the test group, specifically what I learned to do that I didn't know how to do before was to apply my theory to sealed decks. So when you play sealed, it's actually very different than draft. When you play sealed, what happens is you get this pool of cards and you have just those cards. There are no more cards coming. You're never going to see anything else. So what becomes right for this specific set of cards is very different than what would be right in a vacuum. In some pools, you will do things that are crazy in a draft. Like, for example, maybe you have an aggro deck, and it's really important in your aggro deck that you keep your curve low and all your cards trade favorably with regards to mana at the opponents. That is, like, they're all cheap if they answer opponents' cards. And so, like, you might do something like Cut Throttle. Throttle is a 5-mana expensive kill spell, which in draft you would never cut. You pick it highly. But in sealed, sometimes your aggro deck just doesn't want this card. It doesn't matter that it's good in a vacuum. And once I learned to apply my theory to sealed, I started winning a lot more in sealed, and that was a lot to do with the test group.
I love it. That's awesome. What's right in this sealed pool is different than what's right in a vacuum. That's one takeaway I got right there. And I love that. I love how you knew exactly your role and how to fill it and were able to contribute to this awesome team. And I love how you laid it out. It's so cool that Matthias was able to put together builders and evaluators and good players and limited and constructed and, you know, theory crafters. And that's really neat. Like, how Let's say someone wanted to do that in their own area. How do you go about finding players like this? How do you identify, you know, these different skill sets?
Yeah, I'm actually fairly qualified to answer that question. So I'm going to tell a story and then I'm going to ask the question. Hold on. So what actually happened here is when I graduate college, I will move back to Ann Arbor for my job. This is approximately a year ago. And when I did this, I was like, Matthias' test group was really successful. I should try to do the same thing in Ann Arbor. And I kind of did. I was like, who are the best players that I know? Who has strength that I need for my team? Who are up-and-coming players that potentially could be great? Like, who can I invite to this test group? And I got together this group of players, and we all started winning a lot more. The group of players I'm referring to is what I would... I think we're going by Team Ann Arbor right now.
Didn't you guys just have three players in the top eight?
We had two in the top eight, yes.
Two in the top eight, okay.
Me and Max McVetti were both in top eight. Tyler Hill also cashed the tournament from our team. He was not in top eight, but he did finish in... He finished at 11-4, I believe, which is good for cash and two pro points. And since that happened, all of us have been on the pro tour a number of times since we started Team Ann Arbor. So we're pretty good. To clarify, the team I'm describing is me, Mac McVetti, Tyler Hill, Stu Parnes, Kyle Boggums, and Brian DeMars are like the six core members of our team.
Sweet. That's a good team.
I mean, I think so. And anyway, I assembled this team at the beginning. And so what assembling a team, what's key when you assemble a team is this. Don't make it sound like something that we're just doing. You got to make it sound like this is like a serious test group for the purpose of succeeding, and make it sound exclusive and cool so people want to come. So like you don't just invite people. You're like, you know, I'm doing a test group of the best players in Michigan. We are doing this test group for the purpose of qualifying the Pro Tour. We're going to achieve this goal. You know, I think you're good and I respect you as a player. You should come to my test group. That's like key when inviting people. And then as far as getting a good group that works, like, problem that you're going to have when you're making this group is like, so just start off by inviting the best players you know in your area, you know, the best players you can get to come from your area. Because obviously, you know, some of them might not know you or might think they're better than you, although they maybe shouldn't do that, but they might do that. So you get the best players you can get to come. But then you're going to realize you have holes in your group. You know, maybe like you've invited these good players, but like you realize no one can play limited. Well, like, I don't know a great limited player to invite to my test group. So what you got to do is you got to find someone who like has potential. Someone who's clearly not their ceiling, someone who's improving rapidly. But they might not be that good yet, but they will be. And find someone who has that skill you're missing. That skill's limited. And like find someone who like keeps crushing all their local drafts at FNM and seems to like really understand the format at a deep level. Even if they've never cashed a GP yet or anything, you know, it's just clear that they're like getting there and they will someday. And those are the kind of people you invite to fill out your test group. So I guess that's what's kind of key to doing this. And I think that like finding a group of people to work with and test with and start doing well at big events with is very important to succeeding. Magic is not an individual game. It's a game that you play as a group to some degree, even if when you sit down at the table, it's just you there.
Oh, man, I love it. I just, you conjured up visions of Ocean's 11. I could just see Danny Ocean scouting out Linus as he's, you know, pickpocketing people. Is this guy good enough? Does he have potential? I can see you standing there. All right, look at that guy. He just 3-0'd his draft and determining if he has potential. And I love it. That's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot about like discrete skills in Magic, like what precisely are people good at? What are they bad at? Like, and I try to understand for everyone, myself included, like what their strengths and weaknesses are so that I know like what to listen to which people on, you know, like, you know, for example, like Max, who's on your show recently, is like an extremely good aggro mage. So I know that if Max says that like a particular player, a particular sideboard plan is right for like a red aggro deck, he's probably right. And I could probably put a really high value on that opinion. Now, if he makes a different opinion about a control deck, I'm not saying I'm going to ignore him, but I'm definitely going to put a lower weight on that opinion when he's talking about decks that are really his style.
Yeah. Whew, man, that's good stuff. I really, really like that. And I think that that's applicable to anybody in any locale. You know, like you said, you can start assembling that team, that core group, and then filling out the weak spots by just going out and identifying the up-and-coming players in your area. So that's really cool. Continuing down your journey, Andrew, we all have highs and lows as we go through our Magic experience. And I really want to hone in on two events here. The first one being your worst Magic moment and what you learned from that event. Can you tell us that story?
Okay, I can. It's pretty recent. This is last year at GP Dallas, which is the last Grand Prix of that season. And what you should know about last year is that I ended the season with 17 pro points. Now, to hit silver level, which is the lowest pro level, you need 20 pro points. So I nearly missed. And the story is that going to last Grand Prix of the year, I in fact have 17 pro points. So I'm really hoping to get those last three. Because if I get those last three, then I qualify for two pro tours essentially. So what happens is I'm playing the last run of day one. I'm at 6-2. You need 7-2 to make day two. If I lose, I am out. And I'm playing this match, and I miss some land drops in game one. My hand is a little land light, but I still make some plays. You know, I'm scrapping it out and hoping to get there. My opponent has this Angel's Tomb. An Angel's Tomb is a 3-mana artifact that whenever... Sorry, the format here is is M15 limited. And my opponent has Angel's Tomb. So Angel's Tomb is a 3-mana artifact. Which it has whenever a creature enters the battlefield under your control, it becomes a 3/3 angel creature with flying until end of turn. And even though I've kind of stabilized the ground, he keeps hitting me with this angel tomb. And then since I'm land like, he starts playing bigger and bigger spells like, he starts playing 4/4s and 5/5s, and I'm still stuck on land. But finally, I hit my fifth land drop, and I have in my hand Tragic Arrogance. Now, Tragic Arrogance is one of the best cards in the entire limited format. And basically what it does is, it says that you get to choose one creature, one thing of each type, creature, artifact, enchantment, and planeswalker for each player, and they have to sacrifice all the rest. So you get to pick their worst guy and your best guy. So it's a very good card in limited. And I cast and I kill all his 4/4s and 5/5s, I wipe out all of his guys, just the 2/2 left, I leave myself with 3/3 or something, so I still have a pretty good creature in play. But Angel's Tomb, unfortunately, is an artifact. And since he only had that one artifact, I had to let him keep the Angel's Tomb. And even as I start to stabilize the ground and take over the game, he keeps hitting me for 3 in the air, turn after turn with Angel's Tomb. And I've already gone to a low life total from the early game where I was behind missing land drops, so I end up just dying to his Angel's Tomb when I'm really far ahead on the board. I'm like, okay, that's unfortunate, but tighten up, you know, we can still win this match, it's not over. So I play game two, and this time I keep a hand that's has a fine number of lands, and I've got a reasonable mix of spells. What my hand lacks is it lacks red mana. Now I have a white 2-drop in my hand, so it's definitely a keep, but I have just no access to red, and I just draw red spell after red spell, but I have Tragic Arrogance once again, so I'm like, okay, I think we can do this, you know, I again take some early beat, but I know I'm going to sweep this board, I'm going to be way ahead on cards, everything's going to be great, and my opponent, again, the turn before I'm going to sweep him, plays Angel's Tomb. Then I cast my Tragic Arrogance, wipe away all his guys, and he plays a creature for the next 3 turns, and I was at 9 life, so I just took 3 hits in the Angel's Tomb, and I died. And that was really brutal, since that meant I didn't make day 2, I didn't hit silver, and I lost 2 games of limited format where I cast one of the very best cards in the format. So that was really unfortunate. It was definitely one of the worst I've ever felt about Magic in a long time when that happened. I was considering taking a break from the game, but I kind of said, I think the lesson here is kind of this. You know, no one deserves to win. You know, the fact that I was playing against this random guy, and that I was close to silver, and the fact that I cast this really good card in limited both games, you know, did not mean that I deserve to win the match. You know, I think that I was so focused on this Tragic Arrogance plan that I didn't consider that I might just lose even though I cast it. You know, maybe I should have chump blocked creatures earlier to gain life. And maybe that wouldn't have mattered, but I think I was just felt like I was crushing him, and I felt like I was better than my opponent. I had the Tragic Arrogance, and I basically lost to my own Tragic Arrogance, if you will. So that was a pretty bad beat, and definitely my lowest point of Magic.
Wow, no one deserves to win. I like how you were able to articulate that, and that, yeah, what a to be so close, and then yeah, be kept from it. I can see how that'd be a low point. So thank you for going back there and sharing what you learned from that. We can all, you know, improve our mindset from that. So thank you. On the flip side of our lows are our highs, and we would love to hear your proudest Magic moment to date.
Okay. My proudest Magic moment. Sure. It's gotta be one of my Grand Prix top 8s. Accomplishments certainly feel great. I mean, it's called accomplishments, you know, now as for which one, I think I honestly felt better about this one, and the that is GP Minneapolis very recently, and the reason is because the whole tournament where I was crushing and winning and doing great, my teammate Max was right there beside me doing great as well. And you know, at some point in the tournament, I was 10-0-1. He was 11-0, and we were paired. And Max very graciously conceded to me because he was already queued for the next Pro Tour as well. I needed to top 8 the events to qualify. And, you know, from that point on, we kind of sat next to each other, tables 1 and 2 the whole tournament. You know, everyone, I would go to Max and be like, how'd you do? He'd be like, I won. And I'm like, I won too. And we'd like do these running high fives. And I don't know, it was just, it felt amazing to be winning alongside my teammate. And I guess I've never really had an experience where, like, someone I was so good friends with and worked so hard with for so long was doing very well at a big event, and I was too. And then we both made top 8. It was just surreal. I don't know. That was probably the best moment I've ever had. Was just, and when if I had to criticize a single moment, the moment is it's the last round of the Grand Prix. I'm sitting at table 1. Max sitting at table 2. We know we're locked for top 8. We know we're locked, in fact, to be the 1 and 2 seeds in the event. Like, that just felt amazing.
That's awesome. Winning alongside a teammate. That is a very unique experience because, you know, as we all know, we could go to an event with buddies and teammates and they may or may not do as well as we are. And so the fact that you were able to do that, and like you said, you're sitting side by side, table 1 and 2. Oh, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing. That is so, so cool. So yeah. Cool. So there you go. There's the highs and the lows. You know, we all have this unique journey. We love learning and hearing yours. And as you have played Magic, you've probably played thousands of games. You've just seen so many lines of play. And we love diving into that knowledge and tapping into your expertise because we, the Prodigies, we know that we can't win every time, but we want to learn every time we play. And so what is the deepest thing that you've learned about yourself from playing Magic?
Deepest thing that I've learned about myself? Interesting. It's probably this. Okay, as I mentioned before, something I do a lot in Magic, and I try to figure out what people are good at and what their strengths and weaknesses are, so I know when to listen to them and when to not, and what sorts of items they're strong on and weak on. And through the process of doing this, I got to thinking a lot about, like, what I was good and bad at in a very general sense, and I, you know, kind of, like, got pretty good at, like, self-evaluation, like, knowing what I need to work on, what I'm strong on, what sorts of tasks I should be doing in a group. And I think that served me very well in general. You know, like, even outside of Magic, like, at my job, I know what kind of programming tasks I'm strongest on. And so I know, like, what sorts of tickets I should pick up and what sorts of tickets I should need for others to do. And I know when to ask for help because I know what areas I'm weak on. And I think just understanding your own strengths and weaknesses is something Magic has really taught me a lot of that. And I think that anyone can benefit from that knowledge.
Love it. Absolutely love it. And then on the technical side of Magic, what's the biggest mistake that you've seen players make? And then how can we avoid that mistake?
I think that the biggest mistake that players make, or at least here's a big one. I think that players will often be unwilling to acknowledge when, okay, everyone wants to seem good, you know, like everyone wants to seem like a pro and always make the best decisions and always play the best decks and that sort of thing. And sometimes you need to acknowledge that, like, the best deck in a vacuum just might, you might just not be good enough to play it yet, or you don't have enough time to test it, or, like, even if it has a higher win percentage in a vacuum, it just doesn't have high enough win percentage for you. And I've experienced a lot with regards to Tron, personally. Like, where, like, you know, I have a big upcoming event, and, like, I know Tron's not very well positioned right now. I know that it's a bad choice for the metagame, but I also know that I can play the heck out of it, and I probably can't learn another deck in, like, 2 or 3 weeks, you know? Maybe some very talented players can, but I certainly do not learn decks that quickly. So oftentimes the right play for me is to just play Tron anyway, even if I know it's not the best deck. And by the same token, sometimes you'll play a tournament where you know the best deck is something specific, like, I don't know, at GP Indianapolis, I knew the best deck was just Kai Black, for example. I just was pretty sure that the best position was in the field. Everyone I talked to seemed to think it was favorable against everything. But I'm really bad at mid-range decks that, like, aren't clearly out of control in any matchup that, like, switch roles a lot. And just Kai Black was totally like that. So when I played it at the event, which I did, because I was the best deck, I just lost to everything. I just couldn't win a match. Like, and I think players too often want to play the deck they perceive to be the best, when instead what they need to do is just accept that, you know, a deck they're very familiar with, a deck that they might have a higher win percentage with due to familiarity, sometimes that's the right choice. Not always, but sometimes you just got to stick with what you know.
I could not agree more, because you just hit really close to home for me, because I did the exact same thing at GP Oakland at the beginning of this year. I played Jeskai Black and I got crushed, and it was the best deck of the time. But that's when I learned personally through firsthand experience that my skill level was not where it needed to be to pilot that deck, you know? So when you started going into that, I was like, wow, like this is, yeah, it's so true. It's so true. Cause it's a lesson that I know I've learned, and we definitely hope that, you know, you prodigies up there can learn from us and understand that, hey, sometimes you just play the deck that you're familiar with, even if it's not the best one, because you might not have the skill to pilot the best one, and you can get there. You just need to make sure that you give yourself enough time to practice it before you go off to, you know, some big event and, you know, do poorly because you just want to play the best deck. So that is so true. I definitely, definitely second your motion there, Andrew. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing. That's so cool. And then I guess turning the lens inward a little bit, what are one of your shortcomings? What are you working on as a Magic player?
I have a couple weaknesses. So one of them is, like, I'm good under pressure, but I don't practice like I play. So what that means is that, like, so it's true that, like, when I'm sitting under the spotlight at a Grand Prix playing at the best in the world, you know, that's when I play some of my best match, which is great. You know, like, when I think, you know, I think one of the best games I've ever played was when I was on camera against Sam Black at GP Omaha and Roots topping that event. However, like, the flip side of that is I don't always play my best, like, in the early rounds of tournaments or when I'm just play testing or, like, when I know that there's not as much on the line, I definitely play worse. Like, and what this means is that, like, you know, I lose early in day one of Grand Prix a lot, and, like, I sometimes scrub out of, I tend to have, like, big finishes or, like, no finishes. Like, I scrub out of a lot of Grand Prix, but I top eight some of them. Like, I'm not very consistent, and I'm really trying to get my mind into a place where I can always play my best and feel like every match matters, but I'm certainly not there yet. Right now, I'm very much on or I'm not. And it's a big problem. And, like, when I start autopiloting, with, like, when I start just, like, making every decision instantly without thinking about why I'm doing it, what happens is, like, my plays tactically will be reasonable. Like, I'm not, like, throwing away creatures or, like, you know, just, like, making horrible attacks. But, like, what I am doing is, like, you'll start to realize that, like, Andrew doesn't actually know how he's going to win this game. He's just, like, making plays that are all kind of reasonable individually, but he's no game plan. He's not thinking about the long term. And since, like, thinking about the abstract in the game, like Magic Theory, is one of my big strengths. When I do that, I get way, way worse. So I'm really trying to work on that. Like, stop autopiloting, slow down, think about the game. Like, I have a pretty naturally fast pace of play, so, like, slowing down is definitely part of it. That's definitely what I'm working on right now.
Bam. I mean, I really like that. That's so insightful. Like you said, yeah, practicing how you play, like, when you're up there. And I love how you focused in on signals. Like, you recognize, hey, here's something that I notice about myself. When I start autopiloting, then that's a cue to slow down, like you said, and really think about your decisions. Do you have any other tips or advice or anything else, any other angles that you've looked at to practice how you play? Because I think that's great advice. I think that we can all benefit from that much more. Do you have any other ideas on how we can practice how we want to play?
I don't know if what works for me works for everyone, but what I can say is this. So somehow for me, I am benefited, like, I play better when I put pressure on myself. When I put myself in, like, high pressure situations, like, I will rise to the challenge. And so what I've kind of been trying to do is, like, make it seem to me as though every match is intense and every match is serious. And, like, it's stuff like when I'm playing Magic Online at home, not be talking to my roommate about whatever, like, I need to focus and take a serious match that really matters. And I need to do things like, I've been trying to, I post my results pretty publicly on Facebook so that, like, you know, I know that, like, you know, if I lose this match, I'm going to have to post that I lost on Facebook, and I don't want to do that, so I better win. And, like, I don't know, that's the kind of thing I've been trying. Now, I admit that some people have their first problem. Some people, when the pressure is on, play worse, and, like, techniques to put pressure on yourself will not work for those people. But if there are other people out there like me, where you're at your best under pressure and you're weak, when you're, like, you play your worst Magic against some random guy in round one of a Grand Prix, like, then you might want to consider trying to make every match seem serious and intense and try to put pressure on yourself. But, you know, it's not for everyone.
Yeah, but I like that. I like how you said, Yeah, identify what kind of player are you. And I love this tip, you know, posting your results, because, hey, if you have to go public with your results, then that might be, you know, what it takes for some players to add that pressure, you know, because that's what we're looking for. We're looking for ways that we can make a midweek practice session serious. And that might be, that's a good tip. That's one way that, you know, people can try, see how it works for themselves. And if it works, then keep it up. You know, that's a way that you can add pressure. And I love that. I just love exploring this idea of things that we do outside the game to help us get better in the game. And I really love, absolutely love that stuff. So thank you for sharing. That's super cool. So Andrew, bringing things to present times, what would you say is your best or your favorite format?
Probably modern format, the most success in format I've won the most in. I mean, true story. So while before Duke of Minneapolis, very recently, I have day-2'd standard events. I've never cashed a standard GP before. I top-8ed this one. So standard is probably my worst format. Modern is probably my best, with limited in the middle. And it's really all about Tron. I mean, I could go on and on about the deck, but Tron is my favorite deck. It's my best deck. It's the only deck that when I play it, I feel like I could really, I don't think I'm world-class limited. I don't think I'm world-class standard. I might be world-class maybe.
Love it. I love it. I love the confidence. That's great. What would you say to a brand new modern player? Let's say, you know, someone who's just getting into the format. What's one thing that a new modern player should focus on?
Modern is not a format about switching your deck every week. In standard, sometimes the right deck to play one week is Green White Tokens. The next week, you switch to a control deck. The next week, you should play Mono White Demons. Sometimes you just want to switch decks week to week as when a game gets. Modern is not like that. It's not like that at all. In modern, what you want to do is you want to pick a deck that's good and has been good for a while. Not like a new trend. And just learn it. Learn it backwards and forwards. Play the deck a ton. Know every matchup, even like the obscure ones and the weird ones. You know, like know like your sideboard playing against Ad Nauseam, your sideboard playing against Boggles, and like just really get into this one deck. And when you do, you'll start to realize just your results will improve. I promise. Like modern is a format about knowing your deck. And I've really succeeded in the format by knowing my deck backwards and forwards. You know, I have teammates who see with the same thing. Like, my teammate Tyler Hill just plays nothing but Infect Modern. He plays Infect in every event. Like, for during the Eldrazi winter, when Eldrazi was best deck by far and everyone was playing Eldrazi, he, like, 12-3'd and cashed a GP playing Infect, even though it had a bad Eldrazi matchup, according to most people. You know, modern is about knowing your deck. And that's my advice to a new player in modern.
Love it. Thank you. Thank you very much. So pulling into the home stretch here, we just have a few more things we want to cover. As you travel around and go to these bigger events, GPs and whatnot, what do you take with you? What is actually in your tournament bag?
Sure, I can talk about that. I don't know if it's all that interesting, but I'm off life paths. I've decided that I go through too much paper that way. So I've been using a boogie board. I highly recommend that since it's just you don't have to deal with paper. I typically just take changes of clothing, a boogie board, my deck, and a playmat and dice. And if you're playing a deck that makes a lot of tokens, you might want tokens just to keep the battlefield clear or not. That's basically all I have. I don't know if it's particularly insightful.
No, that's good. Especially, I like the point of the boogie board. Like, I've seen those popping up in my local game store a lot more recently, and I was like, oh, hey, that's cute. But you have a great point. It's, you know, you get to cut back on paper. Like, I think that's really insightful. So that's neat that you shared that. So thank you. Let's see a few more things. What do you do that you feel like, do you have any habits or any activities that you have that you feel contributes to your Magic success?
I will say this. I drive to a lot of Grand Prix. I do fly to them occasionally, but I drive pretty long distance to Grand Prix a lot. That's not necessarily my tip, but I'm getting to it. So, and something that happens every time I drive to a Grand Prix with my team is that we will innovate small changes to the deck on the car ride. Seriously, like every time. You know, like I just know like I'll get in the car, Kyle will be in the car, Max will be there, the whole squad will usually be in the car, and we have like, you know, 6-hour drive, you know, a lot of time to kill. And we'll start talking about our deck and our sideboard plans. We'll slowly realize, you know, I think we actually have one too many sideboard cards with a gun matchup. We're like, we'll be like, you know, I think we're actually very soft in this matchup. We're like, maybe our sideboard plan doesn't work in some place. And like, we just end up fixing up the deck on the car ride. And I think my tip is this, like traveling with people who you know, respect and like is great. You know, make every effort to do that. And don't be afraid to, if you innovate an idea, it makes sense in theory, You know, the logic is sound. Don't be afraid to change things last minute. Like, at GP Minneapolis, which is an event that I top-aided, you know, recently, the main innovation in my deck was I had Eldrazi Displacer and Banished Humans, which no one had had before. And literally, the story is, like, I flew to the event, but my teammates all drove. And at 12:30 at night, the night before the tournament, I get a call from Stu Barnes, my teammate. He's like, hey, Andrew, we added 3 Eldrazi Displacers to the main deck, and we changed the mana base to support it. And I, like, mull it over for a bit. I talk it over back and forth with Stu. And I'm like, okay, I'm in. And I, like, buy the cards on site and play these Eldrazi players that I played 0 games with. And they were unreal all day.
Wow.
That's awesome. So utilizing that travel time and respecting the fact that, hey, you can change last minute if it's right, if you've gone through the exercise to make sure it's right. That's awesome. Absolutely love it. Well, prodigies out there, once again, if you want to connect with Andrew, the best place to do that is on Twitter. He's at AJE8888. So hit him up there. Say thank you for coming on. Talk to him about Tron. He obviously loves Red Green Tron, so we didn't even scratch the surface on that. So you can definitely get advice from him, especially if you are looking to play that deck as well. So, Andrew, what is one last parting piece of guidance that you have for us? Either something you've already said you want to emphasize or something new that you want to leave with us here at the end.
I think that I would just like to leave people with advice and just reemphasize what I said before. You know, Magic is a team game. You're at the table alone, but your teammates are always with you. Find people in your area who are around your skill level and who have the same goals that you have. Get them together, form a test group. Just meet weekly. I don't care what you're trying to qualify for, be it, you know, get on the Pro Tour, qualify for RPTQ, day 2 of your first Grand Prix. Just get people together, test, make friends. It's a great way to play the game. It's fun and it's effective.
Andrew, I want to acknowledge you for your contributions to the multiverse. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your expertise with us. You are a hero among planeswalkers. It's been a blast chatting with you. May you always draw what you need and depart every plane victorious.
Thanks. I really appreciate it. It was fun to be here.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today. As always, prodigies, you can find these show notes at mtgprotutor.com/AndrewEllenBogan. Go check out the show notes as well as links to any resources that were mentioned in the show. Speaking of resources, one of my favorite ones is Puka Trade, and I want to bring it up specifically today because Puka Trade is about to launch their new interface. It's called Future Sight, and they gave me a backstage pass and let me take a peek around this week, and I am really impressed with what I see. My favorite feature is the fact you can now use Puka Points to get Magic Online cards. So if you have paper cards, you can trade them to somebody for Puka Points, and then you can use those Puka Points to get Magic Online cards. So you can basically turn your paper collection into a Magic Online collection and vice versa, which I think is amazing. Because the economy uses Puka Points, which is, you know, separate from the cards themselves, we're able to translate one to the other using this common medium. So I'm pretty excited to see that when it launches. Like I said, I've been poking around the back end. The interface is very beautiful. If you're on Puka Trade right now, expect a beautiful facelift. If you're not, go to mtgprotutor.com/PukaTrade. Sign up now, and then when they do the whole rollover, you'll be in there already and you'll have everything set to go. I think it's a great resource for trading your cards at full value with other people. If your play group or those who frequent your local store don't have the cards that you need, Puka Trade is a fantastic way to trade and receive cards. So, like I said, pretty excited for their upgrade. I might actually get into Magic Online now that I can turn my paper cards into digital cards, and I look forward to seeing what other features they introduce in the future. Once again, mtgprotutor.com/PukaTrade. Sign up through that link, get some bonus points for your account, and you'll be off to the races. That does it for today's show. Thank you so much for joining me today. Tune back in on Friday for Pascal Maynard, who has been crushing it this season and has a lot of really good things to share with us. Can't wait till then, and I look forward to interacting with you on the internet. You can find me most readily on Twitter at Sean Penrod. So feel free to tweet at me and we can carry on the conversation. Well, that does it for today. I'm Sean of the Gathering, and we'll see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.